Hi, and welcome to the Finally Pregnant podcast, the podcast for people who are finally pregnant after infertility and loss. I'm your host, Kat Strawbridge, and after almost 7 years trying, multiple rounds of fertility treatment, which have sadly included pregnancy loss, I am finally pregnant. Hi there, everyone. How are you doing? Welcome to episode 8 of the Finally Pregnant podcast. This week in the UK, we are experiencing a massive heat wave. I don't want to say unbearable. I don't want to complain about the weather, but Ren is 6 weeks old now, and looking after a 6 week old baby in this heat is really, really difficult. You just don't know if they're obviously going to be too hot. She's slept an awful lot. She isn't eating as much as I thought she would be. If you think back to the lactation specialist that I spoke to a couple of episodes ago, there was a heat wave when we spoke. And one of the things she mentioned is you might find that your baby feeds little and often because they need to get the hydration. And Ren spent most of today asleep, if I'm honest, but she has had a good feed this evening, which is great. Breastfeeding has definitely improved. It is a kind of a time thing and a getting used to it on both parts for her and me. And I'm really fortunate that I've got a lot of milk. Had a weird experience the other day where I might have like sprayed my husband with some of it, which wasn't deliberate. But yeah, that's a bit wild. So today we're going to be talking about screening, and I'm interviewing a guy called Professor Gordon Smith, who is just a really, really, really lovely man. Many of you may know that at the beginning of our pregnancy, we were expecting twins, but sadly, just before week 10, we lost one of our twins. Now, something that I haven't spoken about that was affected due to that, obviously, you know, on top of the grief that comes with that, and the, you know, I have spoken about the juxtaposition of the feelings of the grief, but that you've lost one of the twins, but the happiness that you've got like a live baby growing inside of you. It's a really, really difficult and strange situation. But one of the things that is a consequence of having lost a twin is that you can't go forward with screening as you would if you had had two live twins or a singleton. And that was really difficult, actually, because we had wanted to do the Harmony test. We are that little bit older, and, you know, we did have some concerns about the health and well-being of our baby, stroke babies, and it was something that we definitely wanted to test. And I know that that isn't the case for everyone, but for us, you know, we've been through a lot. I don't know what we would have done had results been kind of X, Y, and Z. You know, it's not something that we had thought through, but, you know, we did want to have screening. And interestingly, I do think, and I talk about this in the interview, I think a lot of the IVF community, the fertility community, do have the screening and do have the Harmony test screening. And I do wonder why that is. But, you know, we were looking to do that, but unfortunately, because of our twin loss, that wasn't possible. And Professor Gordon Smith, he does talk about that a little in our interview. I met Gordon because as a result of being unable to have the initial screening, we were investigating having an amniocentesis. And just after Christmas, we were about week 17, 18, we went and had a conversation with him. And where we live, the hospital we're at, you book an appointment and you have a consultation and then you have the amniocentesis immediately, like as part of that consultation, if you decide to have one. Now, the risk of something going wrong is 1 in 100. And when we got there, myself and my husband were 100% we were having the amnio. We had done a lot of research, you know, for people who had done it and how nervous they were and how it was all fine. And when we got in there, we had a scan and neither of us could do it. And we did go off into a separate room to, you know, have the conversation. They were amazing and gave us loads and loads of time. And we just decided that actually we couldn't risk anything happening to our miracle baby. And we loved them. And to be honest, that was never a concern. You know, it was more about our mental health and looking after a child potentially with disabilities rather than anything, you know, rather than them. You know, we knew that they were going to have a good life, whatever the case. But it was kind of a bit of self-preservation and self-care that we were investigating, you know, how much could we handle, that kind of thing. So we decided against the amnio while we were in that consultation. And if you want to hear more about what an amnio is, you know, Gordon will talk about that during the interview. But what he did instead was he went through like a really, really, really detailed scan from head to toe just to see if he could identify any markers. And there were none evident, which was fantastic. So, but I have to be honest, it was something that did play on my mind throughout the rest of the pregnancy. And that was quite difficult. But anyway, she is amazing. She really is. They literally grow so fast. I know it's a cliche, but it is so, so true. I spent some of the beginning of this week changing her wardrobe over from the up to 1 month and newborn over to the up to 3 months, which is just frightening, quite frankly. That's it for now. I'm going to stop waffling on because we have got an interview to hand over to. I want to thank you so much for listening. We've got a couple more episodes of this series, and then I'm probably going to have a little bit of a pause while I gather some more interviews. I've already started talking to some amazing people, and do let me know if there's anything specific you want covered or you want to hear about, or if you have any amazing people that you think that they should be on here with me, I should be interviewing them. Do send them my way as well. And that's it, other than to say, please do subscribe, do rate and review the podcast. I think between me and you, I think most of that is on Apple. I think that's the place you can do it. You might be able to do it other places, but I think most of it is on Apple, which isn't something that I've got, so I can't do it. But yeah, if you have, please do. And do share the podcast as well. It's amazing to see like more and more people on the Instagram community in particular, for me anyway, getting pregnant. It's just incredible. So, you know, it's always good to remind people that this podcast is there, because as far as I'm aware, it's the only one of its kind. And so it's just really important to get it in front of them, because I've heard such amazing reviews from people who need it and are really pleased that it's something that's been created, which is just incredible to hear. I can't thank everyone enough for letting me know things like that, you know, when they get back to me, because it's just, that's why I set it up, because I know that I struggled and needed the support and needed to kind of hear some of the things that are being discussed in these interviews. And so I really love hearing that you guys are getting what I anticipated from it. So please do share it far and wide so that other people can benefit too. I am definitely going to stop now because I clearly didn't the first time, but have a lovely day. Enjoy this episode and I shall speak to you soon. All right. Thanks a lot. Take care. So I'm here with Professor Gordon Smith, who is the head of the University Department of Obstetrics and Gynaecology in Cambridge. This is the hospital that I am at, Adam Brookes, which is a fabulous hospital. Gordon is distinguished for his work, particularly in maternal fetal medicine, and he's going to talk to us a bit more about that in detail in a moment. He has a CV as long as both of my arms, if not longer, and he's highly qualified and experienced. And today he's going to be talking to us about screening, specifically managed by the NHS, because, as you know, we don't really ask those questions until we're right on top of that situation. And I think it would be really beneficial to get a bit of an idea about what it is, what it entails, and what the potential outcomes are. So thank you so much for joining us today, Gordon. Yeah, I really appreciate it.
Happy to help.
Because, as we discussed, I'm just going to fall over all the words. If you could expand on what I've just said about your job, because it is vast, that would be great.
Yeah, so I'm employed by Cambridge University and I'm a clinical academic. So one major part of what I do is around research, and a lot of that research is around screening, but it tends to be around the complications of the second half of pregnancy, high blood pressure, preeclampsia, fetal growth restriction and stillbirth. I also work clinically in the Rosie Hospital, but that's entirely focused around maternal fetal medicine. So I have a full day of fetal medicine, and then I have an antenatal clinic as well, where we see women mostly with pre-existing medical problems, in particular diabetes.
So kind of higher risk pregnancy.
Yeah, so it's I would never usually see somebody who was low risk. It's usually I'm seeing somebody because of some sort of problem or something's happened.
Okay. So as much as you're lovely, we don't want to see you, ideally.
Yeah, I have said that to friends. You don't want me to be done up. But there's a lot of what we do actually clinically. I describe one part of my job is de-terrifying people. People have been given information that has terrified them. And I'm sort of actually then trying to say, well, you've been told you're high risk, but what does that actually mean? What's the absolute risk of something bad happening to you? And quite often being high risk, many of those women actually are still in a situation where the most likely outcome is the pregnancy is going to be normal.
And I would say that, this is a sweeping statement, but after you've had IVF or any fertility treatment, and you might during that time, or you know, when you've been trying to conceive, have had pregnancy loss as well, there is a tendency, sweeping, like I say, to want to be in the high risk and the kind of consultant-led capacity during your pregnancy, because you're so used to, you know, a lot of attention. And when I say attention, I mean, you know, a lot of appointments, a lot of contact with a consultant. But I guess, you know, what you're saying is that's not, you know, it's not necessary. Even a lot of the time where people are high risk, you know, actually they go on to have normal pregnancies.
Yeah.
So we shouldn't be so desperate to be in that.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things about coming to a doctor is there is always the potential that by coming into a sort of medical model, you end up causing harm. You know, that's one of the things that we're very conscious of, particularly when we think about screening in the second half of pregnancy, and particularly when we think of screening low-risk women. If you're in a situation where most women are going to have a normal outcome, you know, the danger is you perform a screening test or you make some sort of assessment, and then you start doing things to that person. And those things can usually cause anxiety, will always cost money, and can sometimes do lasting damage. I mean, one of the key things that determines the health and outcome for the pregnancy is the stage where the baby's born. Babies do best if they're born 39, 40 weeks, around that sort of time. One of our interventions is to bring forward the delivery, and babies that are born early don't do so well as babies that are born when they're supposed to. So there is the capacity for doctors getting involved and offering interventions to make things worse. And you know, there are some parts of the world where the medical model is highly interventionist, where babies will be delivered prematurely on relatively, you know, what we would regard as soft indications. And you know, these babies experience short-term complications and they perform differently at school. They have, you know, on the average, will have different IQs later on. You know, so the idea of seeing a doctor, you would hope in the normal course of events that you see a doctor and it makes things better. But one of the things as doctors we have to do is be informed by the possibility that we have the potential to cause harm by intervening in a situation where it's not required.
Which only goes to reassure me more, unfortunately, that you would, how good you are, because you would only do something if it was entirely necessary.
Yeah.
Like, actually, what you want is to kind of leave this woman alone and let the pregnancy happen.
Well, yeah, and what we're trying to do is another thing is we're trying to do the thing that carries the lowest risk, and that there's never a zero risk situation. The only zero risk is if you're not pregnant. You know, it's we're always trying to find the path that carries the smallest risk of a bad outcome. Sometimes that's intervention, sometimes that's doing nothing, and a big part of the job is differentiating the people who are going to benefit, the women who are going to benefit from intervening and you know, sort of say higher levels of surveillance and possibly early delivery. So just to flesh that out, sometimes the early delivery will save a life. You know, if you're in a situation where you've detected severe fetal growth restriction and there's other complications, that early delivery could prevent the stillbirth that then yields an entire life lived. Alternatively, it could be an unnecessary intervention and you permanently affect the child's well-being. And that's the dilemma we have every day, is weighing up their capacity, the possibility that we might be causing good, and weighing it up against the possibility of a mite causing harm.
That is a huge dilemma. That is just such an enormous job.
It's a biggie.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. I really can't. But kind of, trying to let that sink in, what I'm going to ask you to do is kind of to bring you to the beginning of a pregnancy or the early stages of a pregnancy. And very straightforwardly, you know, around 12 weeks, you come in for your scan. And that's when you have, you know, your standard screening. Now, as we've talked about earlier, you know, a lot of people, and I'd be really interested, listeners, you know, why you think this is. So do get in contact with me. But I know that a lot of IVF and fertility patients, when they do get pregnant, do end up having what I know as the Harmony test. I appreciate Harmony as a brand. And I wonder why that is, but a lot of us do. But there is standard NHS screening, which, you know, is what most people do. And I'm sure that, I don't know whether people have Harmony testing and the standard NHS screening. It seems a little bit overkill, to be honest. But can you talk us through, you come in for your 12-week scan with a sonographer. What kind of screening happens then on the NHS?
Yeah, so there is some screening that takes place which isn't related to the sort of chromosomes, etc. So there's certain tests which are done in all women. All women are screened for syphilis, for example, HIV, the abnormalities of hemoglobin. So there's a bunch of actual maternal things which we probably wouldn't go into in this context. The 12-week scan, they're making a measurement of the fluid at the back of the baby's neck, a thing called the nuchal translucency, and they measure the levels of two proteins which circulate in the blood, which both come from the placenta, PAPI and free beta HCG. And each of these provide independent information about the risk of Down syndrome. So you take the mother's age-related risk of Downs, and then each of these measurements then generates a ratio, a multiplying factor, and you put all that together, and then you get the summarised risk of Down syndrome. Now, one of the sort of slightly artificial elements of this is that it gets turned into high risk versus low risk. So what's generated by the screening process is a number. It might be 1 in 100, it might be 1 in 1,000, it might be 1 in 10,000, it might be 1 in 5. For the purposes of the NHS screening, anybody whose risk is 1 in 150 or greater, higher risk, is offered an invasive test. But then there's an arbitrary element to that. The difference between somebody's risk is 1 in 149 and somebody whose risk is 1 in 151 is within the measurement error of the laboratory tests. So you have to set a slightly artificial threshold. But the problem then is the mother is given this label. So you say to the mother, you're high risk or you're low risk, but you could take two women whose results are virtually identical. One of them gets the high risk label, one gets the low risk label, and they respond completely differently. Partly that sort of faith thing, well, they wouldn't tell me I was high risk if I wasn't high risk.
Yeah.
But it's a practical thing. When you have a continuous scale, you have to decide at some point on the scale where you decide you're going to treat women differently. Now, the 1 in 150 threshold is actually based on, we don't want to be doing too many invasive procedures. So we want to be doing invasive procedures on less than 5% of the population. And it's actually that false positive rate is how many women would end up be offering amnios, which determines the 1 in 150 threshold, not because there's anything particularly sort of magical about it.
Really? Gosh, okay. So it is, that's how it's calculated.
So sometimes you end up dealing with women whose risk is, you know, maybe 1 in 140, and it's one of the things to convey is, now in that situation, there's a 1 in 140 risk of Downs, but there's a 139 out of 140 risk the baby doesn't have Downs. So another way to reframe that is there's a greater than 99% chance that the baby doesn't have Downs. Now, if you'd given the mother her risk of a screening result saying there's a greater than 99% chance the baby doesn't have Downs, it would have cause for celebration.
Yeah.
Exactly the same number can lead to the high-risk label. And there's a whole science around the communication of risk. So there's a fantastic place, an institution in Cambridge called the Centre for the Public Understanding of Risk, which is run by a guy called David Spiegelhalter, who's a fantastic statistician. But that whole idea of how do you communicate risk to people is a science of its own.
And I, you know, being from the fertility community or infertility community, you know, there's so much information out there. Well, there isn't, but there is about the stats and things like, you know, pregnancy rates and success rates and live births. And we're not unused to dealing with numbers and dealing with the way things are communicated, because you're right, you know, and people pick out certain bits of research and kind of manipulate it. And and one thing that we do know is that, you know, there isn't enough research ultimately. So anything we're hearing often is just being twisted into a way that kind of a clinic or a person wants it to be, because there isn't any finite evidence out there for a lot of the IVF. But so we're used to, I understand what you're saying, I think is what I'm trying to say. It is about the way you hear it and the way it's told. You mentioned there amnio, so that's an amniocentesis. So if we stick with the original screening that you have, and many of the things you say, certainly HIV and other bits and pieces, like we have that all through our IVF. But if we go to the screening, are there any times where you can't have screening, or?
Yeah, so there's certain, probably the major reason people miss screening is actually gestational age. If you get beyond a certain point, we can't do the screening test. So the way it works is, in the early stages of pregnancy, in the first trimester, is what I mentioned, the nucleotide resistance in the two markers. If you get, say, up to 15, 16, 17 weeks, there's a second type of blood test called the quadruple test, and that's another way of assessing the risk of Downs. But that's only useful up to about 20 weeks, and then at that point and beyond, it's impossible to get a risk. And there are certain specific circumstances, say if you have a twin pregnancy and there's early demise of one of the twins, you can have the age and the nucleotide resistance, but not the protein test. So there are complexities within that, but it's probably true to say that the vast majority of women who come along will get something which is a refinement on the age-related risk. You know, that's the minimum is this is the risk based on your age. We can almost always refine that. Even in that twin case I mentioned, you can still take the nucleotide resistance and use the combination of age and nucle.
Uh-huh. And that is why, you know, you have, I suppose, a 12-week scan, because that's within the time period. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't realise until I, you know, was pregnant that the 12-week scan isn't always 12 weeks, is it?
No, we aim for 12 weeks. You know, things being as they are, some women, you know, come later. But if a woman presents earlier in pregnancy, then they'd always try and schedule a week. The 12-week timing is principally because that's one of the best times to do gestational dating. Mm-hmm. So when we make a measurement of the baby at 12 weeks, we get an estimate of the gestational age, which is accurate within plus or minus 5 or 6 days. Okay. And the dating the pregnancy is really one of the things that informs everything else that happens further down the line.
Yeah, although we know the dates.
You guys know, yeah.
We do have a slightly different view.
Yeah, there's a different perspective.
We're very specific.
From the IVF group, yeah,
no,
for sure.
Certainly. Yeah. And so if you have twins, if you are expecting twins, then you can have that normal screening.
Yeah, so if there's viable twins, then there's an adjusted level for the proteins which allows you to make an assessment of risk.
Mm-hmm. And so if you can't for any reason, or if there is a risk, what happens next?
In relation to invasive testing?
Yeah.
So the two tests that are available for invasive testing are CVS and amniocentesis. The reason why there's two is that one of them can be done earlier. So CVS can be done from 11 weeks onwards, and you can do a CVS at any stage. From 15 weeks onwards, we tend to do amniocentesis, and we do that because it's a less uncomfortable procedure. There's occasional complicated results with a CVS. So about 1-2% of CVS samples have a genetic quirk, which means that you may end up needing an amniocentesis anyway.
So
the amniocentesis is the, and it's a less painful procedure. So the amnio is the better of the two tests in a way. But the advantage of the CVS is it can be done earlier. You can only do an amnio from 15 weeks onwards. You can do a CVS from 11 weeks onwards.
And can you talk us through, like, practically what a CVS is, what it entails? Not into too much detail, but just kind of...
So we do a scan, first of all, and check the viability and the size of the baby, check the position of the placenta. The placenta has to be accessible such that you can put a needle straight into it. So it has to be at the front, the top, the bottom, or the sides of the womb. If it's perfectly at the back of the womb, it's not possible to do a CVS. Having established where the placenta is, prepare the tummy for a sterile procedure, introduce some local anaesthetic into the skin where you're going to insert the needle, through the skin, through the tummy wall, into the placenta, and then the needle's in the tummy for about 30 seconds, being moved backwards and forwards, where we remove the sample of placenta under suction, take the needle out, and then that's the test over. Check that the sample looks okay, and then the rapid test for the major chromosomal problems would usually be available within 3 working days.
Mm-hmm. And then an amnio, and then we'll talk about the risks of both of them.
Yeah, so an amnio, if you've done it 15 weeks, in many ways similar. You do the ultrasound scan, you check where you're going to, you check that the baby's viable, check the measurements of the baby, prepare for a sterile procedure. The difference with an amnio is you don't use local anaesthetic because it's a much finer needle. It's a finer needle than you use to give a local. It used to be more painful to give a local than it would be to do the amnio. The amnio needle goes through the tummy wall and it goes into the sac where the baby sits. Take between 15 and 17 millilitres of fluid, which is about 3 teaspoons of fluid from around the baby, and then remove the needle at the end of the procedure. Now, you can't see any reduction in the fluid. This is a small quantity of fluid in relation to how much is there. And again, same results, 3 days to get the rapid test of the common chromosomal problems.
Yeah, 3 days, which, yeah, is difficult when you've days, had, yeah. Yeah, the kind of 2-week wait and all of the other waits, yeah, you know, 3 days doesn't sound a lot, but obviously, you know, at that point, there's quite a lot riding
there's
on it.
There's a huge amount at stake, yeah.
Definitely, sure. Definitely. And so can you talk to us about the risks that with each of those procedures?
Yeah, so different people quote different risks. We tend to quote a fairly conservative estimate of about a 1 in 100 chance of a miscarriage with either procedure. Most hospitals will audit their own results, and there's thresholds set for where you would be concerned about the number of losses. The losses here are way below that threshold. Losses tend to occur 1 to 2 weeks after the procedure, and any loss that was more than 2 weeks after the procedure we tend not to consider to be related to the procedure. But it's principally infection is the major cause. You're doing something in a sterile part of the body, and there's always the danger you introduce infection, and that's why we're particularly careful about the way we prepare the tummy beforehand and the way we do the whole technique.
And I think, like, I found that really interesting because, and I don't know whether this is just me being silly or what, but I assumed the risk was that there would, you know, that you'd puncture the sac, yeah, that kind of thing, yeah, not that it would be a bacterial thing.
No, so you can get situations with an amniocentesis where you've gone through the membranes and there's subsequent leak of fluid. I've seen that twice in 20 years. In both of those cases, actually, the leak stopped and the pregnancy carried on to term and the baby was fine. So you would think that would be the obvious way you'd lose the baby, but actually it's a rare complication, and it's not an uncommon. I think the majority, actually, if it's assuming there's no infection and all it was is a leak of fluid, it seals up again and the pregnancy continues.
That's amazing, isn't it? It really
is. Yeah.
Like, it's amazing being pregnant anyway, but I'd like to think what can happen.
What's going on?
It is, the whole thing is just miraculous. It really is. And so what about later on? You know, you said that your studies generally are later pregnancy screening, in fact. Yeah. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
Yeah, so that's an area of particular interest for me. So the sort of mainstay for screening for low-risk women in later pregnancy are visits with the midwife. And those visits, the midwife will ask about the baby's movements, ask about the mother's health in general. In terms of actual screening tests, the midwife will generally measure the blood pressure, check the urine for the presence of protein, and measure the size of the bump with a tape measure. So you're measuring from the pubic bone up to the top of the uterus, and then that's plotted out on a chart. And that's really screening for abnormalities such as a very big baby, a very small baby, an increased amount of amniotic fluid. And those are the really key things. So if the uterus is either too big or too small, that then triggers a referral for ultrasound, and then the ultrasound would quantify in more detail the size of the baby, the estimated size of the baby, and also the fluid. And that's the triads that really detect complications. Blood pressure and urine measurements are looking for a thing called preeclampsia. That's where the mother develops high blood pressure and kidney dysfunction during the pregnancy. And the ultrasound things are principally looking for fetal growth restriction, where the baby's hasn't grown at an appropriate rate, and that's often because the placenta's not working so well. And then those babies would get extra monitoring. And in both preeclampsia and fetal growth restriction, there really is just one intervention in the second half of pregnancy, and that's early delivery. And that goes back to what I was saying before. It's this balancing of what's the risk of continuing the pregnancy versus what's the risk of delivering the baby at the given stage. And from our research perspective, might be a controversial thing, but probably the ancient Egyptians had tape measures or something similar to tape measures. So it seems amazing to me that in the 21st century, the backbone of screening for fetal growth restriction is you take a tape measure and you measure from the pubic bone to the top of the uterus. And I've published that I want to be the person lighting the bonfire of these tape measures when we replace it with something that works better. Because the reality is it doesn't work well. We pick up about 20% of small babies with these sorts of measurements. The problem is that the obvious alternative is to scan everybody, just to do ultrasound scans on everybody through the last third of pregnancy. But that gets back to this, the problems of screening. So you take somebody who's low risk, healthy, doesn't have any problems, and you do a scan, and you think the baby's small. Well, sometimes you'll get it completely wrong, the baby won't be small at all. Sometimes you'll get it right, the baby will be small, but it's a healthy small baby. Sometimes you'll be kind of right, it's fetal growth restriction, but it would have been fine if you'd done nothing. And then there's just that small proportion of the ones that you screen and detect where making that diagnosis actually would result in a better outcome. And the problem is people have done big randomized controlled trials of taking huge numbers of women and allocating them either to be screened or not to be screened, but universal ultrasound. And we can't show that scanning everybody results in benefit. And that's probably because the good that we're doing through detecting the true cases is being cancelled out by the harm that we do to falsely identifying babies as being small, intervening, and then you know, actually making things worse. So a big thing for our research here is how can we have better methods of screening for these complications of late pregnancy where we can screen and intervene and actually cause net benefit, which is harder to do than you might think.
I was going to say, obviously you're not going to give away any secrets, but are you progressing?
We published a paper last year where we combined ultrasound measurements with a blood test. And it's a bit like Down syndrome screening. It's looking for that combination of things that gives us more information than just one thing on its own. So Down's screening works based on age, ultrasound, and blood test. What we've been looking at 36 weeks is a combination of ultrasound, blood test, and some other maternal factors. And we think we have a combination that works. But the next thing is a trial. So we've just got funding to do a randomized controlled trial where we screen women at 36 weeks using this method and then see whether identifying the high-risk women and intervening improves outcome. So that's the whiteboard has my plans for this study. And a lot of my day has been spent today trying to turn the sort of proposed research into reality.
Uh-huh. And I'm just trying to have a look, and you definitely have doctor's handwriting. Yeah. And it's small, and it's, yeah. I'm not going to be able to translate any of that, people. Right. Sorry. Sorry. We'll just have to... It looks very neat. I just can't read it properly. Not this quickly, anyway.
It's a long-term plan. It's going to take years to do the study, but the hope is that we end up with something which we can do in late pregnancy. And, you know, it's partly... my idea is you scan women at 36 weeks because you have an intervention, early delivery at term. Early delivery of the baby always has the potential to cause a bit of a problem, but the later on you are in pregnancy, the less. And once you get to 39 weeks, there's actually an argument for delivering all babies at 39 weeks. That's a whole other story. But you're not going to cause harm at 39 weeks. But we think if we screen at 36, then there's a benign intervention, which is slightly earlier delivery of the very high-risk women. And then once we can show that we can do that at 36 weeks, then maybe screen earlier as well and try and pick up a greater proportion of the complications.
Yeah, like it just is fascinating because even so, you know, just from my experience, I saw my midwife earlier this week because I was just concerned about something, and I had an appointment this week anyway, so we just moved the day, and she measured me, and I'd been measuring just under what would you call it,
the symphyseal fundal height.
Yeah. Or we'll just stick with fundal height. That's what I remember. And I've been measuring just under, which, you know, maybe it's an IVF thing, maybe it's an everyone thing. You know, as I was within the white lines on the chart, so I was happy, but I was a little bit kind of a bit concerned. You know, you want to be on the line, you want to be right on the middle line. But I was rationally trying to, you know, not worry about it. And then suddenly over the course of the last month, I've jumped up. So I'm just over the line. And I did have a bit of a kind of a mild, oh my gosh, you know, what's happened and, you know, what's going on. Fortunately, I happened to have a scan. So I booked in as well the following day. So I went to that. And the sonographer said to me, you can't necessarily tell because you don't know what position the baby's in. And I know when I look down, sometimes my left side of my tummy is bigger than my right side. You know, so the baby moves position, which can affect that measurement. So I can see what you're saying. Maybe I'm making this up and talking nonsense.
I don't think it doesn't seem controversial to me that maybe a tape measure isn't the best way of screening for fetal growth restriction.
That's it, exactly.
It could be something better. Having said that, if there are people who are listening to this who have actually been pregnant, there will be some who will have been told the baby's very big, the baby's very small, and it turned out to be completely normal. So when there's an error of 15% of the estimated size of the baby, even with an ultrasound scan, in about 1 in 4 cases.
Okay.
So we say the baby is, for example, 4 kilograms. You know, what we really mean is there's a 75% chance the baby is somewhere between 3.4 and 4.6. So we give these very precise estimates of fetal weight, but actually there's a huge area of uncertainty around them. It kind of makes sense. If you measured my head, my tummy, and my thigh bone, you wouldn't expect to be able to predict my weight terribly accurately.
No.
So it makes sense that the same is true for fetuses. But we do believe there is information we can get from these estimated fetal weights. But I think combined with other things, that's where we'll actually get, it will be clinically useful, but that's kind of the research thing. But it is just, even ultrasound isn't perfect in terms of assessing size.
And there's the human thing, isn't there? Because everyone measures slightly differently, you know?
Yeah, and we'll quantify that, actually. We have taken 50 women and got 2 sonographers to make measurements of the baby. And the ultrasound measurements themselves are actually reasonably reproducible.
Okay.
Look at it. I mean, it goes back to just the biological variability. You measure head, thigh bone and tummy, and it's not going to be a perfect prediction.
Okay, so we're hanging on, because we are hanging on to every single decimal point, everything.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is that, you know, a lot of this is estimates.
Yeah, that's exactly. Noisy estimates.
Yeah, and so where you do have the kind of the white bit in the chart, which is the kind of, you know, as long as you're between those lines, you're okay. Mm. Like, we really need to listen to that if we're in between those lines, we're probably okay.
Yeah.
Sometimes we just need to hear that, though.
And the starting position is most of the really bad things in pregnancy are rare. You know, and it's one of the things that makes screening difficult. You know, screening becomes much easier if things are common. But you know, the people who are sort of worried about this, for most women, it's going to be fine. It's only a minority that go on to have a serious problem.
Mm-hmm. That's good to hear. Reassuring. Yeah. Brilliant. I think we'll leave it there rather than opening any new cans of worms. Yeah. But thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.